Culture and Rural Development Committee to order for Monday, February 25th. We have four bills on our agenda this afternoon, members, and we're going to start out with... Right. And just for the record, let it note that we do not have a quorum yet, but I'm sure members will start coming in, but we'd like to get started. So we're going to have Senator Senjum present Senate File 343. Senator Senjum, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 343, otherwise known as the Destination Medical Center Bill, is a unique bill, I think, in many cases. I have done a little bit of research, and I will certainly stand corrected, but it would seem to me that it may well be the largest economic development bill ever offered in any legislature at any time, maybe in the history of our country. We talk about Boeing Airlines moving to South Carolina. We're talking about 9,000 jobs. Auto manufacturers going into either Tennessee or Texas, we're talking in the neighborhood of generally 2,000 jobs. This particular initiative, Mr. Chair, is talking about in the neighborhood of 25 to 35,000 jobs. So that is enormous in terms of investment, both in terms of human capital, but also $3.5 billion in terms of facility capital going into the infrastructure. And in fact, more than that, with private sector investments estimated up to $5.5 to $6 billion. So this is a very, very major bill, and we bring it to you today for certainly your consideration and hopefully review and hopefully passage. So I would just simply offer that as we think about Mayo Clinic and think about Rochester, you're probably all well aware that Mayo Clinic is a world leader, frankly, in healthcare, medical research, medical education, the largest employer, in fact, in Minnesota. Generally speaking, in any given year, it will bring about $3.9 to $4 billion worth of financial economic revenue into the state of Minnesota, and that is huge. That is one of our certainly largest revenue producers in our state. I did a little research also again today, and that's equivalent to about 8 Super Bowls. So when you think about this little facility in Rochester, so to speak, bringing in revenue, that is a lot of money. Mayo's position as a global medical destination is a reality, but sustaining that position is certainly not a foregone conclusion. And so we have Senate File 343 to provide going forward the continued growth, innovation, private sector investment, public infrastructure, and so on and so forth is really going to be necessary to sustain Mayo and all that it does on into the future, and in fact to magnify what we have already in Rochester to a position that even I, who have worked there and did work there for 44 years, can hardly imagine. So again, before you we have Senate File 343, Destination Medical Center Bill, serving patients literally throughout this nation and this world, and of course in the state of Minnesota, a bill that will provide not only advancement in terms of medicine, but certainly economic advancement in terms of what it will do for the state of Minnesota. In short, Mayo plans to invest in the neighborhood of $3 billion, $3 to $3.5 billion in terms of facilities. An additional $2 billion will be brought forward by private sector, non-Mayo investments, complementing what's going to be going on within the Rochester community as a result of Mayo's initiatives. I've mentioned earlier maybe in the neighborhood of 25 to 35,000 jobs will result in all of this, and these are obviously jobs of a pretty good stature from the standpoint of the salary, medical benefits, and so on and so forth. As we think about where this goes construction-wise, in the neighborhood of perhaps 2,000 jobs a year for upwards to 20 years and maybe even a little longer because the life of the bonds do go longer than that. So moving forward, a lot of certainly consideration needs to be placed in that area as well. Hundreds of thousands of new patients over and above what already comes to Rochester will be planned on and accommodated within the new vision of Destination Medical Center. Approximately $3 billion worth of new tax revenues will accrue and more than likely be coming also to Minnesota and also then to state government. The whole thrust of this, Mr. Chair and members, is that as Mayo grows and as Mayo magnifies not only its investments in health care and education and research, so will tax revenues grow within the state of Minnesota. The idea here then is that part of these tax revenues, income tax, sales tax, business property tax, and so forth, will come back, at least in part, to Rochester, Minnesota, to take care of the infrastructure needs that apparently, you know, that without question have to occur in order for all of this development to occur. In short, this only happens in a retroactive fashion. If nothing happens, then nothing will accrue back to Rochester. If literally $25,000 to $30,000 jobs occur, and if $5.5 to $6 billion worth of investment occurs, then there certainly will be some bubbling, if you will, that occurs, and there will be a fair amount of money that accrues back to the state of Minnesota, and in fact, then retroactively back to Rochester. So that's the essence of all of this. As we think about Mayo and as we think about Rochester and think about Minnesota, why this is needed. Mayo is a very large organization in a relatively small community, albeit for many of you, 100,000 people is not small. But as you think about this organization, as you think about what the city needs to do to support this organization, you cannot literally do it going forward on the tax base that that is naturally occurring as a result of just normal activity in Rochester. So we need some infrastructure tax support above and beyond the normal to make this happen, and that's the essence of a Destination Medical Center. I have with me a couple of witnesses. There's about three or four. I'll introduce and turn now to Dr. Patty Simmons, a Mayo physician, and she will pick it up from here. Patty?
Thank you, Senator Senjum. And before you go, Dr. Simmons, I just want the record to indicate that a quorum is present. So thank you for your introductory remarks, Senator Senjum. And Dr. Simmons, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much. I'm Patricia Simmons, a physician from the Mayo Clinic. Chair Sparks and honorable senators of the committee, thank you for the privilege of coming before you to discuss what we believe is a very exciting project. This is a multi-billion-dollar, multi-year economic development project that we're very excited about at Mayo Clinic in the community of Rochester and really for the state of Minnesota. For its history of 148 years now, Mayo Clinic has been a destination of hope and healing for people from all over the world. People come to the Mayo Clinic to Rochester from all 50 states, from 145 foreign countries. Every year at Mayo Clinic, we'll have in Rochester 500,000 individual unique patients come, and they bring people with them. So we have about 3 million visitors come to Rochester every year, and we are very happy to have them come. They are tremendous patients. They're stimulating. They are also great for this state's economy. They allow Mayo Clinic to stay at the cutting edge because of the unique kinds of problems they bring. We're able to invest in our infrastructure, in our research, our education, to take care of the most difficult challenges that people face in healthcare. We believe that's very good for Minnesota for a number of reasons. As we've analyzed what's going on in the healthcare marketplace and in the economy, we have to look at Mayo's future and determine what we best do next. There are many challenges. There are places throughout the United States, three or four major institutions, and at least that many in the world that want to be the Mayo Clinic, that want to be a destination healthcare place. We want to retain our position for the sake of our patients, for the sake of Mayo, and for the sake of Minnesota. We've decided that the best strategy for us is to invest in Mayo Clinic to grow in Rochester, to grow in Minnesota. In order to do that, we will need to make a very high level of investment over the upcoming years, and we're anticipating and committing $3.5 billion. We expect that to leverage an additional $2 billion. And with that, with the assumption and the help from the state in developing the infrastructure for the community to accommodate our current and growing volume of visitors, we believe we have something very exciting to offer. I'd like to share with you just a couple of slides because I think they'll make the points better than I can with just words. We employ directly in Rochester about 40,000 employees. We are the largest private employer in the state, and about another 44,000 indirect jobs result from Mayo Clinic. We're big. We have 15 million square feet we use for our work in Rochester, and our economic impact on the state of Minnesota is substantial. We account for 4% of the gross domestic product of the state. It's a almost $10 billion economic impact annually, and of course a substantial amount of that is tax revenue. Our people who come to Rochester to work, this intrigues me, come from many of the places you know, the places where you are and your constituents are. We have employees come to Rochester from about 60 counties throughout Minnesota. So you probably, some of your neighbors come to work in Rochester. They'll tell you about all the visitors that come to town. We're very proud of that. We think it strengthens Mayo Clinic to have representation from other areas of the state, and we know we strengthen those economies too. The Destination Medical Center project has really extraordinary economic impact potential. This would generate an incremental number of jobs in the 35 to 45,000 range, direct jobs and indirect jobs. The jobs I can speak most credibly about are the jobs that Mayo Clinic would directly account for. About 14 to 16,000 jobs over this period of time would be created. Those are jobs for physicians, for scientists, for healthcare workers, for people who engage in technology commercialization. These are good jobs. Jobs are good. These are really good jobs. The incremental economic impact on the state, we anticipate and estimate, would be an additional $2.5 billion annually. Other people are going to talk about the project, but may I please leave you with these thoughts. Mayo Clinic wants to grow to retain our status as a destination medical center. We want to spawn additional industry around us, and we know we can. We count on being able to leverage additional private investment. We count on the state for investment, but only on that state investment after we've demonstrated and brought the incremental revenue to the state. So we believe that this is a very safe a decision for the state. It's Mayo Clinic and the private sector who first go at risk. The direct benefits to the state of Minnesota are great. They're not just to Rochester. They're not just to Mayo Clinic. It's a statewide economic impact. And finally, we think this will help keep Minnesota the state of medicine. With that, I'll let others speak, and I'd be very pleased to take your questions, Chair Sparks.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, representing the City of Rochester, Assistant City Administrator Gary Newman.
Mr. Newman, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again, Chairman Sparks and members of the committee. I'm here today filling in for our Mayor, Ardell Brady. He would love to be here, but he's currently at an important event, a cruise with his grandchildren. So he obviously needed to be there. He does send his regards, though, to the committee, and he prepared a letter, which I gave to the committee administrator to distribute. From the city's perspective, we have been working very closely with Mayo Clinic to develop a plan that we believe will further establish Minnesota as a global leader in healthcare for the future. We strongly support the DMC vision and plan. The mayor and city council have unanimously adopted a resolution in support of the Destination Medical Center initiative, and we will be supporting the DMC financially. Approximately $60 million of the public costs will be financed by the city through local financing tools such as the Rochester City sales tax, revenue bonding, tax abatement, and tax increment financing. We already have skin in the game. The city approved $20 million in sales tax funding in our referendum that was held in November of 2012, and that was by a 2-to-1 margin on the sales tax vote. The economic impact from Mayo drawing several million new patients and visitors annually to Rochester, and I believe that is the projection when you add patients and visitors, will benefit the county, the region, and the state, and it'll generate a significant boost to the state economy, creating thousands of new jobs and billions in new tax revenue. The overall growth and success of that project in Rochester will also benefit the whole region. Mayo currently provides employment benefits and family to families throughout the Southeast Minnesota and the region. And I would note that an estimated 51,000 people commute to Rochester for their employment, which is a large number. We have a strong coalition of community organizations, local government, businesses, and others who are committed to this DMC plan and the passage of this in the legislative session. We stand ready to work with the state to make this project a reality for Minnesota. We think it'll have great benefits for Minnesota. Thank you, Chairman Sparks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Newman.
And as Chair and members, introduce Shay Mandel, who from Life Science Alley has some comments, followed by Harry Melander. I'm sorry, Harry, you might as well come up.
Mr. Mandel, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members of the committee. I'm Shay Mandel with Life Science Alley, and Life Science Alley represents nearly 700 businesses and organizations in Minnesota working in the life sciences, and our nearly 700 organizations employ over 250,000 Minnesotans. And so we're really excited to be here today on behalf of Rochester and Mayo to stand in strong support of this really unique and innovative initiative. This is really about statewide. Minnesota has one of the most unique life science ecosystems in the world, and you all know that. And Mayo is really kind of the critical core of that for our businesses. The Mayo model is the gold standard for healthcare, for research, for education around the world. And everybody else wants to have it. And increasingly, competition for the Mayo model is all around us. And we see every day companies and organizations that look at other states as destinations, other competitors as destinations. There are public dollars on the table. And so we know how critical it is that Mayo continues to sit in the position that it has been, sets the standard, but also as we recruit patients, doctors, researchers, as we look to build more companies out of Mayo Research, as we look to work with companies that can feed our next generation of pharmaceutical companies, medical device companies, healthcare leaders. Mayo is really the core of that. And so it's critical that Rochester have the opportunity to really provide the support, the amenities, both for Mayo, for Minnesota, and for patients coming in from around the world. We are competing with Cleveland and Baltimore, Boston, San Francisco, and other global destinations. And as people have more choices, as they continue to look at different aspects, it's really critical that I think we protect and allow for the opportunity to grow this truly unique asset that is uniquely Minnesotan and is critical to the ecosystem that we support in the life sciences. So strongly urge the committee to take action and to support Mayo's objective and Rochester's objective. We need Mayo Clinic. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Mandel. Mr. Melander, how are you today?
Good, Senator.
Good.
Chair, committee members, Senator Sedgham, my name is Harry Melander. I'm here on behalf of the 55,000 men and women that work within the construction industry throughout the state of Minnesota and a significant amount in southeastern Minnesota. As you know, these have been very, very tough times over the last 7 years, and with your help over the last couple of years, we were able to put people back to work, and we're very, very appreciative of those efforts that you make. This project, like others that the state looks at, as Senator Sedgham indicated, will create thousands of construction jobs annually, which equate to millions of work hours in each of the years that this project moves forward. This is what we like to call in our industry a generational project, a project that will last for a decade, hopefully a generation. Our organization has had a long-standing relationship with the clinic. Presently, we have over 200 people working there as we speak, and we have had that relationship for many years. This is a regional center for us. Rochester really serves southeastern Minnesota. It provides somewhat of a hub for people within the industry and really a place where individuals can gain employment. This private-public partnership is becoming very, very common around the country. With this private partnership and ones like what we're looking at here, it will continue to have growth within southeastern Minnesota, which will affect everyone in Minnesota. These are very, very competitive times. Again, thank you for your consideration. This is good for the region. It's good for the state. It creates good jobs. It's a great private-public partnership, and it brings stability to Minnesota workers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Melander. And I think we have one more witness, Senator St. Jim. Mr. Dunn?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Bob Dunn, president of the Hammes Company. The Hammes Company has been the lead consultant with the Mayo Clinic on the Destination Medical Center effort for the better part of the last 3 years. And you've heard testimony this afternoon that frames what the economic development opportunity is for Minnesota, driven by the DMC project. And it's fair to say that it's a very significant opportunity. This is the type of work that we do throughout the country, and I would go as far as to say that I don't think that there is another single economic development initiative in America today that has the potential impact that this project can have for the state of Minnesota. And some of the specifics that you've heard center heavily around jobs. We're talking about something that could have an impact of 25 to 35,000 new jobs created here in the state of Minnesota. And as Dr. Simmons said, it's an interesting balance of jobs because the jobs are so heavily weighted toward professional-level jobs, which is uncommon for this type of initiative. But I think the best measure that we can use to understand the impact of this project and what it will mean to Minnesota is, you heard earlier today, Rochester generates about 2.5 million unique visits a year to Rochester. With the growth that we are anticipating as a result of the DMC effort, that number will grow to upwards of 7.5 to 8 million visits a year. And the reason that's important is if you thought of this in the context of the infrastructure need, given that type of growth, if you thought about your airport here in the Twin Cities, if you were going to increase the volume of traffic through an airport by 3 or 4 times, it would be virtually impossible to shoulder that type of increase in demand and visitation and throughput in an airport setting without significant investment in the core infrastructure of an airport. And that's the dilemma that we face in Rochester today. To support the growth that will be driven by the Mayo Clinic, we need to build core community infrastructure in Rochester that will support this level of growth long term. That is the reason that we've come forward with the DMC initiative. It's to support the private investment that will drive that growth. And that's really what the model is driven around. And what we've tried to do is put together an economic development model that's very unique in how it is structured. Normally on these economic development initiatives, the process that we follow is public dollars, at times in partnership with private dollars, are the first dollars in. Those dollars are invested in the hopes of generating new jobs, which will then translate to growth in tax base. In this case, we've completely reversed that model. What we've proposed to do with the DMC is to structure this proposal where private investment led by Mayo Clinic of upwards of $5 billion of combined Mayo and private investment, those dollars are invested first, which generates certainty around growth in jobs. Those jobs will generate a substantial growth in the incremental tax base to the state of Minnesota. What we propose to do is take a small portion of that growth in tax base and cycle those dollars back into the community to build infrastructure that will then drive additional private investment. So it's a very different way of approaching this type of public-private initiative, whereas typically it's driven by public dollars in first without certainty of growth in tax base. Here what we're doing is driving the model with private investment first, which gives you certainty of job growth, which then gives you certainty of growth in the tax base and the ability to cycle some of those dollars to incent further private investment. So that's a very simplistic way of describing the way that the bill has been crafted to give you a higher sense of comfort and to eliminate the risk that is oftentimes a part of these major economic development initiatives. So that's kind of a general overview of the approach that we've taken. We'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Dunn, thank you very much. Are there any Senator Sengem or committee members, or any Senator?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dames.
Senator Sengem, we're talking 25 to 35,000 jobs. Could you tell me how many of those jobs will be in the construction industry, and then how many of those jobs will be in the medical side of it? Do you have any idea?
Well, Senator Sundin.
Senator Sparks, Chairman Sparks, Senator Dames, the estimates on this are in the neighborhood of, I'm just going to say, 1,800 to 2,000 construction jobs over the course of 20 years. In addition to that, as we've reported, in the neighborhood of 25 to perhaps 35,000 additional jobs. So it's, gracious, you know, 2,000 versus 35,000, or 25,000.
Thank you.
Senator Bono.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sundin, when I had the chance to look through the proposal and really understand the financing package that's been put in here, I would say it's one of the more positive I've been about a legislative idea since I've come to the legislature. In fact, the first thing I said is, can I be a co-author on that bill? I heard the spots were taken. But I just want to say for the record that this idea of really minimizing state risk by saying that, number one, you're going to wait until the private investment happened and the but-for taxes are actually accrued because we've already got the additional revenue, and then you're going to still put a cap in it because you're saying that no matter what, you know, the state's only going to invest this certain amount, and then to also put some safeguards with regard to cash flow and timing, should it still be a huge bonanza. I mean, we all knew when we first heard about Mayo's expansion that this is so important for our state and for economic development, but then to put together a financing package that is so sound and creative that balances risk and opportunity is something I just want to commend all those who've worked on it.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. You know, there's been a lot of people put a lot of time into this, understanding that obviously we want to pass this, we want to get the pleasure, if you will, of the legislature, but also certainly the public. And this is a retroactive, Mayo goes first, state pays second.
Thank you, Senator Sundin. And I would just say that you do have some good co-authors.
And
also that I think that the charge of this committee is really to focus on job growth and economic impact. And this is a unique proposal that certainly does both of those. So we thank you for bringing this forward. Senator Nelson, then Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you. Some of those co-authors are pretty good. But, no, actually, it's a wonderful proposal, and it's just so very thoughtful and Minnesota-centric. And I'm wondering, though, if you could tell us a little bit about why this is so important right now for Mayo Clinic's long-term success. Why are we here today?
Dr. Simmons?
Thank you, Chair Sparks, Senator Nelson, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I'll speak, and perhaps Mr. Dunn would also assist me with that. We're seeing worldwide people wanting to copy the Mayo Clinic model of care by creating, investing in the private and public dollars in institutions to attract that world destination patient. And as we see those investments being made, we consider it'll be difficult to maintain our market position. We do not think that everyone who wants to do this will succeed. We want to succeed, and we've got to invest to be able to do that. We chose for good reason to make that investment in Minnesota instead of elsewhere in the world and the nation.
Senator Nelson.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, Dr. Simmons or maybe one of the other testifiers, can you tell us about some of those investments that have taken place in other states for maybe some of the same type of initiatives as far as destination medical centers?
Yes, Chair Sparks, Senator Nelson, ladies and gentlemen, I can tell you qualitatively, but I believe Mr. Dunn can tell you quantitatively, and that may be advantageous. But we're talking in terms of sites. We're including Baltimore, Cleveland, New York, California, Texas, and the United States, to name some of the key ones. And then in the world, India, Thailand. There's a Mayo Clinic of Thailand, if you will. They advertise about quite a bit. And the Middle East would be big areas, and London would be the major world areas, and Germany. Perhaps you could take it from there, Mr. Dunn.
Certainly.
Mr. Dunn?
Thank you. I'll give you one very tangible example, which I think is probably most relevant to what we're facing here in Minnesota. In Cleveland today, there's a project called the Cleveland High-Tech Corridor. It's a similar initiative to the DMC initiative in terms of it's building off the history and success of the Cleveland Clinic. The results that have been seen there since 2008 are an investment of nearly $6 billion much of which has gone into capital investment, building, if I remember correctly, over 110 new projects. And that's been since 2008, the greatest economic trough that we've had in this country in our lifetime. And given an initiative like this, it has driven one of the most significant economic development programs in the state of Ohio's history. So if that is a result that can occur in a relatively short period of time, a shorter time horizon than we forecast for the DMC initiative, which really means I think we're being highly conservative, and those results occur during an economic downturn like we've seen in this country in the last decade, I think that hopefully will demonstrate that the underlying principles of what we've proposed with the DMC are founded in conservative estimates and built around an institution like the Mayo Clinic, where I think you can eliminate the risk and have virtual certainty of realizing the results that we proposed.
Thank you. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably a rookie senator question. You know, having been here only 7 weeks and I read things in bills and explanations, I still give them real-world meaning rather than legislative meaning. But under the Senate Council's analysis here, in Section 6, Subdivision 5, it defines designated state taxes. And it talks about personal income taxes payable under Chapter 290, attributable payroll and employees of all facilities in the city of any business entity. I understand that. Located in this city, obviously. And all facilities located in the state of any medical business facility. Well, then I get down to Subdivision 8, and it describes a medical business facility. I assume they are referring to any Mayo facility within the state of Minnesota. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay.
Senator Weber.
Oh, thank you. One other question. Do you expect the other Mayo facilities within the state of Minnesota to actually profit from this venture as well?
Dr. Simmons?
Chair Sparks, Senator Weber, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, yes, we really believe that the investment Mayo Clinic and would make into this project would increase our revenues. We're not for profit. So we invest the revenues, the profit, if you will, back into the enterprise. And our enterprise includes segments outside of Rochester. One of our goals for our Minnesota and regional future is to invest in communities so people can receive optimal care in the communities where we have a presence. But yet Mayo Clinic in Rochester is there when they need that second opinion or that unusual high-end care. So, yes, indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Weber. Oh, Senator Conan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Senjum, or either of the testifiers. This is kind of an interesting idea, something that's completely new to me, using increments of future sales, both personal and corporate franchise tax. And the question I ask isn't addressed directly in the bill, at least that I'm aware of, and so maybe you won't have the answers to my question today, but my question is, besides the increments that you're talking about in this bill, will the county or city be using increments on the property tax, in other words, what we've called TIF districts in the past?
Mr. Dunn, you want to try that?
Mr. Chair, committee members, what we've done is to structure the bill where there is a $585 million contribution toward infrastructure, of which roughly 10% of that will be funded locally. And the means by which we can fund that locally is, as you know, Rochester has recently passed, in addition to the sales tax, within that framework, there's $20 million that have been designated for support of the DMC initiative. Over and above that, we would anticipate that locally funds could be generated by using TIF as an example to support the balance of the local funding that would come into the project.
Thank you. Senator Coon? Okay, well,
thank you. That is a very good answer. Thank you.
That was a good question. I think that this bill does have a ways to travel and obviously will make its way to the tax committee, so you'll have some more discussion. But very good questions. Any further questions from committee members? Or Senator Senjum, do you have anything to wrap up with?
Well, I would just say, Chairman Sparks and members, this is a unique place. I had a chance to work there for 44 years. It's it's an absolute master place, or piece rather. It will continue to emerge as that. I think in this case, in this most precious moment in history, it's probably been the first time that Mayo has been, if you will, to the altar of state government asking for a cooperative spirit here in the sense of moving forward. And I hope that we can do that. This obviously will benefit the state of Minnesota in many, many ways, and it will certainly advance medicine in a style that I think we from Minnesota can all be proud of. So hopefully we can move this on and at some point this session bring it to a conclusion.
Thank you very much to you, Senator Senjum, and to your witnesses, too. That was a good presentation. Senator Nelson or Senator Schmidt, are we looking for a motion?
I'd move.
Go ahead.
We'll move Senate File 343.
Okay. Senator Nelson moves that Senate File 343 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Senja. Next, we have Senator Champion with Senate File 488. Senator Champion, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for taking the time to hear this wonderful Senate file. And I hope that after our presentation that you'll feel the same. So would you like for me to go forward, Mr. Chair?
Senator Champion, do you have an author's amendment that you'd like to offer?
I do.
Okay. Senator Champion has an A1 author's amendment that would put the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor, please. Someone's got to move it. That's right. Senator Bonoff would move the A1 author's amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? No. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Champion, to your bill.
Thank you so very much again. Mr. Chair, this particular Senate file is 488, and I thought what would be the best way to frame this bill. So I thought I would start by telling you what Twin Cities Rise is. Twin Cities Rise is an anti-poverty program primarily serving all of the great state of Minnesota, but of course there are individuals from, you know, the Twin Cities and surrounding areas, and so they make themselves available. You know, there was a person who quoted some time ago, he said, the best social program is a job. And so what Twin Cities Rise does is try to find opportunities for individuals to find employment. But its key program elements are basic work skills training, personal empowerment training, coaching, and employment placement services. Extensive internships, opportunities with hiring partners to support job readiness preparation. Supportive services to help participants overcome challenges. And so the population that they serve, the core program served over 624 low-income adults in 2012. And these are the hardest to serve adults, typically with extensive barriers such as generational poverty, criminal histories, chemical dependency, mental health issues, homelessness, and chronic unemployment. And it's predominantly African-American men through the program, although it's open to all. There are no restrictions, and they actually get a cross-section of people to participate. But the individuals also must have less than $7,000 in assets upon entering the program, which is open to all. And so I just thought I'd frame it that way. And my ask today before I introduce the COO, I hope I'm getting her title right. The Chief Operating Officer, that's right, is Shelley Jacobson. Before I introduce her, my ask today is for $450,000. And that's in fiscal year 2015. And we are asking that it be appropriated from the general fund to the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development for performance grants under Minnesota Statute Section 116J.8747. And we are asking that go directly to Twin Cities Rise. To also give you some other background or some additional information about this wonderful organization that's in my district, I would ask if Shelley Jacobson can talk a little bit about Twin Cities Rise.
Thank you.
Ms. Jacobson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chairman Sparks and members of the committee. Again, my name is Shelley Jacobson, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Twin Cities Rise. And first, I'd like to thank Senator Champion for being an author of this bill. We really appreciate his support. You've received an overview of Twin Cities Rise, and I'd like to expand on some of that information. First, our mission reads, "The mission of Twin Cities Rise is to provide employers with skilled workers, primarily men from communities of color, by training under and unemployed adults for skilled jobs that pay a living wage of at least $20,000 annually plus benefits." Now, to respond to that mission, TCR, as Senator Champion said, served over 600 individuals last year. 60% of them had criminal background. Over 50% had chemical dependency issues. 85% were unemployed when they joined the program. Many of them were chronically unemployed when they came to us. 80% were participants of color. All were currently living in poverty when they came to the program. What we have discovered over the years is that the number of barriers facing our participants is not decreasing, but steadily increasing, compounded by the economic realities of our state and country over the past few years, coupled with the job disparity facing African Americans. One thing all of our participants share is the desire for another and sometimes a first chance for meaningful, stable employment at a living wage, and for someone to believe in them and their ability to maintain employment. Now, that may seem something like, well, of course, don't we all believe that we can be employed and that we have the right to be employed? Yes, we do have that right. However, for our participants, many of them have not found that support in the past. They find that support at Twin Cities Rise through career development courses and personal empowerment courses. One of the components of personal empowerment is learning about your core value. Now, core value is something, again, that may seem rather simplistic. I am lovable, I am important, I am valuable. Pretty easy, right? Well, for many of our participants, they've never thought of themselves in those terms. And unless you have that basic sense of self-esteem and belief in yourself, it's pretty hard to move forward and continue in a stable employment position. It is our goal to assist individuals in securing that position paying $20,000 or more. The average is a 371% increase in income from when they start the program to when they leave the program. That doesn't only impact our participants, but it impacts their families, it impacts their communities, and it impacts the state. And we can show through return on investment that for every dollar the state invests in Twin Cities Rise, they receive $7 in return. In addition, the recidivism rate for participants at Twin Cities Rise is 16%. You compare that to the average of 62%. Again, you can see a strong impact on society. And we don't just leave our participants when they get a job. We stay with our participants through their first 2 years in the job. In fact, they don't graduate from the program until they've been on the job for a year. And our retention rates after 1 year in the job are 82%, and after 2 years, it's 71%. If you compare to the city of Minneapolis' recent citation that says 60% is an excellent retention rate after 1 year, you can clearly see that we exceed that by quite a bit. But it's, you know, I'm facts and figures, and I can talk to you about participants from my position in the agency, but I'd like you to really hear from someone whose life has been directly impacted by Twin Cities Rise, and that is Tony Blakey. Tony is a work skills coach and instructor at Twin Cities Rise. Tony?
Thank you very much,
Mr.
Shelley.
Welcome to the committee.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee committee members. My name is Tony Blakey, and as Shelley stated, I am a work skills coach. Well, first and foremost, a proud graduate of Twin Cities Rise, a work skills coach, as well as an empowerment facilitator and instructor. And on behalf of the Twin Cities Rise staff and the many graduates and current participants, I just want to say thank you to all of you for spending a little, for allowing me to come in and spend a little time with you and talking about my story just a little bit. And starting, I would just like to say that as a young man growing up, I was filled with a lot of anger, which often resulted to acting out in violence as a means of resolving issues. A lot of this stemmed from early childhood experiences that ultimately caused me to get into a lot of very bad decision-making, which ultimately I found myself convicted as a felon because of violent offenses. After years of battling a felony conviction, drug, alcohol use, homelessness, and being on the verge of giving up on life, I enrolled in the Twin Cities Rise program as a last-ditch effort to make something out of myself. This was in October of 2007. As a participant, I started out a bit skeptical, wondering whether or not Twin Cities Rise was just another program that simply stated it was going to do something but actually did nothing. I was about 3 weeks into the process and still a little uncertain, filled with some anxiety about the process, when as I sat in an empowerment course, an epiphany came over me, or a light shone or shined within me. And what I was thinking about at the time as we were discussing the concepts of core value, which are the internal belief systems that tell me I am important, valuable, and lovable, and how it connected to power mode thinking, which tells me I am competent and possess the capacity to do anything that I put my mind to. And in contrast to that, we were also discussing the concept of core hurts, which are painful false judgments about the value of self and how that connected to weak mode thinking, which ultimately has people feeling as though they are helpless, dependent, depressive, and destructive, and often are remnants of childhood experiences. Weak mode thinking was something that was always a part of my thought process, especially the 7 years leading up to my time in enrolling with Twin Cities Rise. And the world, in my eyes, was to blame. Because for me, there was no personal accountability or responsibility for my own actions. However, it was at this moment I told myself that I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And if my core values ultimately tell me that my life is of value and has meaning, then no matter what life event comes my way, I will succeed, especially if I choose to remove the self-inflicted barriers often manifested between my two eyes, my two ears. It was time for me to bring brainwashing to a whole new meaning and to begin washing away some of my old thinking. And to create space for a new perspective on life. And with the tremendous support of my coach and the Twin Cities Rise staff, I began to grow in confidence, and my life began to change. My life changed even more as I began to do an internship with Twin Cities Rise, which ultimately led to a front desk position at Twin Cities Rise. And in the almost, in the almost 4 years that I have been on staff at Twin Cities Rise, I have moved to being a work skills coach. I have completed an empowerment facilitators training course. I have assisted with developing and implementing a chemical health education group. I have also completed a year-long training with the Shannon Leadership Institute, which was to help me to enhance my leadership skills. I've also started a men's group at Twin Cities Rise, which has been very successful at helping the men to further break down emotional and mental barriers and to learn that assertive communication is a key component to achieving a lot of their goals. I have also most recently completed the Bridges Out of Poverty trainer certification, which also helps me to really be effective in my job as a coach. So as you've heard here today, TCHR really sets a platform to open up a new world of opportunities, and it starts with holding staff and participants accountable. It is a program that helps out without enabling and aims to assist individuals such as myself to overcome barriers and achieve sustainable employment. With that said, I again just want to thank all of you for your time and hope that you would really consider supporting Twin Cities Rise as a program as it continues on in its efforts to eradicate poverty. Thank you so much.
Mr. Blakey, thank you very much for sharing your story. And I think that, as Ms. Jacobson said, we've heard over the years many success stories similar to yours. So thank you for sharing that with the committee. And I know you guys do a lot of good things here. Committee members have any questions? Or Senator Champion, do you have something?
Yes, I just wanted to make sure that I wrapped it up in a way that makes sense right before any questions are put forward. What we're also asking for is the $450,000, but the model is a pay-for-performance model. And what that is, as you probably know, is that they will receive payment only upon successful participant placement and after he or she stays on the job for over a year. If the organization don't succeed, then they don't get paid. The result is for each dollar the state has invested in TCR, which is Twin Cities Rise, it has received more than $7 in return. And just briefly, from 1997 to 2010, taxpayers have received a net value of $28.7 million on just $4.6 million invested in Twin Cities Rise. And so the benefit is just this. Pay for performance helps policymakers, philanthropists, and taxpayers hold Twin Cities Rise more accountable. It shifts the risk of failure to the organization and provides Twin Cities Rise with an incentive to move individuals into living wage jobs. And so with that being said, we would stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Champion. Senator Rood?
Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, so can you explain to me how your amendment to this bill affects the pay for performance when, if I read this amendment correctly, it takes out all of the pay for performance language?
Before, I think Senator Council might be able to help us a little bit, Senator Rood.
Mr. Fuller. Chair, Senator Rood, members, the underlying statute that's referred, 116J.8747, requires pay for performance. So reference to that statute pulls in, and you get the money, like Senator Champion said, you get a piece of the money upon a successful placement in the job. That's 116J.874. I can read it to you. The commissioner may provide a grant to a qualified job training program from money appropriate for the purpose. That's this money. As follows, $9,000 placement grant paid to a job training program upon the placement and employment of a qualified graduate of the program, and $9,000 retention grant paid to a job training program upon retention and employment of a qualified graduate of the program for at least 1 year. And there are salary requirements later on, $9 right away, $10 later, including benefits. So the language in the statute was, or in the bill, was redundant and also maybe lessened their obligation.
Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that clarification.
I think it was a good question, Senator Rood. I saw some other people that were asking. So thank you. Yeah. Any other questions? Senator Dames.
Mr. Fuller, on the language on the original bill, though, wouldn't that limit the payment until only once the person has been there for 12 months? The language that you just read would allow $9,000 and then $9,000 at the end of the time period. doesn't this limit the language to be paid at all paid after the 1 year? So aren't we changing the bill?
Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dames, yes, we're changing the bill, but the bill was an error. It meant just to give money to the existing program, and the existing program has two sets of payments, one conditioned on placement, the other on retention. So you're right, it's changing the bill, but the bill was an error.
And a follow-up on
Senator
that.
Bonner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, I believe that even though last time they still because I'm a strong supporter of this program, so I've been following it, I believe even when they were given the money as a grant rather than appropriation, the grant still had to follow the same path that was in law. So we aren't, in fact, changing what was done, correct?
Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bob, that's correct. We are changing the bill, but right. The bill was changing the law,
right.
And that was not the intent of the bill.
And Mr. Fuller, Mr. Chair, Mr. Fuller, when Twin Cities Rise last year got their money with a competitive grant from DEED versus the prior appropriation, was the grant money given out in keeping inconsistent with the law?
Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bob, I don't know the answer. I'm 99% sure the answer is yes.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Good questions.
The answer is yes.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobson. And this bill will go to Senator Tomasoni's committee for the funding portion. So, any further questions for Senator Champion? If not, Senator Bonner would like to move that Senate File 488 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee.
Senator Tomasoni, Senate File 549. Hey, guys. What did you want to use? Senator Tomasoni, welcome to the committee.
I have an amendment.
And I believe we are handing out, is it the A1? The A1 author's amendment. You want to move that, Matt?
Will you move it?
Senator Schmidt would move the A1 author's amendment that would put the bill in the shape the author likes it. All those in favor of the A1 author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A1 author's amendment is adopted. Senator Tomasoni, to your Senate File 549.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senate File 549 is pretty well worked out with everybody, but I'll give you a little description and I'll let my witnesses tell you what it's all about. Senate File 549 updates the elevator constructor and elevator contractor license in state law. Currently, elevator constructors and contractors are licensed by the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry within the state's electrical license. So Senate File 549 creates elevator constructor and contractor licenses separate from the electrical license and updates the qualifications required for personnel who install, repair, and maintain elevators in Minnesota. Elevator safety is an important priority for Minnesota, both for the public who regularly use elevators and the personnel who install, repair, and maintain them. Senate File 549 is designed to be an update to current qualifications for elevator constructors and elevator contractors, modeled much after the state's electrical license. The bill has been a collaborative effort between the elevator constructors, union, elevator company employers, and the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, and we'll hear from some of these people today.
Thank you very much, Senator Tomasoni. Which one of you gentlemen would like to start?
Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Dave Osterud, and I serve as business manager for Local 9 of the International Union of Elevator Constructors. Local 9 is comprised of 600 members who make their livings by installing, repairing, modernizing, and maintaining elevators in Minnesota. Our members' work includes installation, repair, alteration, and maintenance of moving walks, automated people movers, and vertical transportation devices such as escalators, passenger elevators, freight elevators, dumb waiters, hand-powered elevators, endless belt lifts, and wheelchair platform lifts. IUEC Local 9 elevator constructors have done this work in Minnesota since 1902. The work elevator constructors do is important to the safety of the public using elevators and escalators. Safety is priority number one for us, both from the perspective of maintaining safe transportation for the public, but also a safe work environment for the workers. Needless to say, the elevator constructor's work environment is a dangerous work environment, full of potential hazards. It is important that elevator personnel have the appropriate training, experience to be safe while ensuring a safe environment for the public. Senate File 549 has been a joint effort between Local 9, the employers, and the Department of Labor and Industry. A process like this means a lot of give and take. We believe Senate File 549 improves safety, and we encourage your support. We want to thank Senator Tomasoni for carrying this legislature and appreciate the committee's support. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Darren DeJoy. I've been in the elevator industry about 33 years. About 19 of those years I spent constructing elevators. I've had about 8 years at the state of Minnesota as a state inspector. I've also been a consultant, and right now I am representing the industry, the owners, and the Elevator Association of Minnesota. I believe that through my years as being an inspector, I have seen unsafe conditions when unauthorized or people that have not had the training or the proper training work on elevators. I believe that by moving it out of the electrical licensing and creating this elevator license, that we're going to ensure that people that are qualified and people that do have experience in these devices are the ones that are going to maintain these devices. I am in support, and the companies are in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeJoy. Thank you both for your testimony. Are there any questions of the two witnesses from committee members? Senator Dames and then Senator Rood. Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, when you introduced the bill, you talked about that pretty much everybody was on board, but there's still some differences to be worked out. First of all, I assume that this is considerably different than what they were going through in relations on the electrical part of the past. So, what areas are there still to be worked out? What's contentious that you're still working out that haven't been worked out?
Senator Tomasoni, or one of your witnesses, Senator Tomasoni?
I think this is probably for the witnesses. I'm of the understanding that there might be some technical questions that need to be worked out, but as far as the gist of the bill, I think people are all on board. I don't know if anybody's here that wants to come up and testify against this or testify to some changes, but as far as I know, what's ever left to do is minor.
Senator Dames.
Would this be a situation to where we should have this bill completed before we're voting to move it forward if we don't know where those indifferences are?
You can certainly ask and see if anyone wants to be heard on the bill, Senator Dames.
Well,
I don't think we're done yet, but yeah, it's something we can certainly consider. Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Tomasoni, maybe you could speak to lately in the Capitol, we've been having a lot of conversation on competency exams. So maybe you can speak to a Subdivision 10 that requires persons to pass a competency exam, and just maybe give me a brief overview of what that involves and who gives that exam.
Mr. Osser?
Mr. Chair, members, that question would lie with the Department of Labor. They do the testing right now. As far as education, elevator constructors have had national elevator education program since probably 1960. Currently, it's the only elevator apprenticeship registered with the U.S. Department of Labor and in Minnesota. It takes 4 years to complete that apprenticeship with 6,800 hours OJT hours. Our constructors, prior to being eligible to be a mechanic, have to pass that mechanics exam, and then they currently have to obtain a state elevator constructor's electrical license. Some of the challenges in this bill, I think the department could direct their the comments to those.
Senator Rhodes. Mr. Chair, and I just have to tell you that I appreciate the fact that you have a competency examination, and as someone who has recently been forced to live in the tall buildings, I appreciate the fact that our elevators are safe.
Good point, Senator. Chairman, Senator, you haven't been stuck in one of them, have you?
No.
No, good.
Is there someone from the department that would like to comment on Senate File 549? We did have someone listed. Welcome to the committee.
My name is John Schultz. I'm an assistant director with the Construction Codes and Licensing Division of the Department of Labor and Industry. My section actually deals with five different inspection categories, boiler and pressure vessel, high-pressure piping, plumbing, electrical, as well as elevator. I'm also directly involved with the development of exams. Previously, I was the executive secretary of the Board of Electricity, under which currently the elevator constructors and elevator contractors are licensed. Again, the vast majority of the work that's related to elevator installations and maintenance is really elevator technology. It's only about maybe anywhere from 10 to 15% that's even related at all to the electrical codes, electrical technology. So it clearly is much more of an elevator technology than it is an electrical technology. Now that all of the different industries or disciplines are in the Department of Labor and Industry, this is an opportune time to really put the elevator industry into elevator licensing and based on the elevator technology. From an electrical codes perspective, aside from just the general code requirements, there's only 10 pages of the electrical code that's over 500 pages long that deal directly with elevator installations or elevator the elevator portion of the wiring. Whereas the elevator code itself is equally in length and much more detailed as it relates to elevators than what the electrical code is. So the department believes it's much more appropriate that this licensing deal with elevator technology rather than it being based solely on electrical.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking about a project that, quite frankly, is going on in my home church congregation. Currently, we have a small two-person, I think it's cable-operated, two-stop elevator. You go in it, it doesn't move unless you keep the button depressed, you know, and what have you. And we're putting in a larger four-stop elevator elsewhere in the church. And obviously, many of our churches and other public buildings have to deal with handicapped accessibility and this type of thing. I know our trustees got a little frustrated. They understand the permitting process to have the elevator installed. No one has an issue with that. But this minor league elevator that's there requiring another permit in order to get out the old elevator seems to rankle a few people there. And I was reading Subdivision 12, Section 5, Subdivision 12, talking about, elevator work also being the decommissioning. I mean, do we go a little bit overboard in these small-scale projects with the requirement for that is my concern?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber, committee members, the removal of elevators can be a very dangerous situation. It's critical that the elevators be decommissioned appropriately, made safe, so that they can actually be removed. understanding, of course, that there are some of those small type elevators that you might say, well, that's maybe a little bit overboard, but they still have to be made safe, decommissioned, removed, so that there is no hazard that's remaining, and understanding, of course, that they're going to vary dramatically from one type to another. In some instances, for example, if you have an elevator that has a hydraulic cylinder that's in the ground, that hydraulic cylinder has to be removed properly. In effect, that well cavity has to be sealed properly. So there's any variety of different requirements that have to be met. And again, for the removal of a small limited service elevator, the requirements would be very minimal. The additional fees would be very minimal. So it's really difficult to categorize them individually. Again, the permitting process is fairly simple, and it's based on cost of projects. So it's very minimal from that standpoint also.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Schultz.
You want to comment on that?
Oh, yep. Mr. Osford?
Yes. Get up here. Mr. Chair, members, 2007, there were significant code changes to the Minnesota Elevator Code. Some of those were a direct result that in 2006, an individual was working under an elevator in Fridley, Minnesota. They were going to demo the building. He was underneath the elevator. It had a remote machine room. It was a hydraulic elevator. Hydraulic elevator, the oil line looks just like water line in a building. His brother was outside the hoistway, cut the oil line, elevator came down on him and killed him. So they put in these codes for the removal of traction elevators and the removal of hydraulic elevators to get those in a safe position for removal.
Thank you. We also had Mr. Melander on the testifying list, if you'd like to come forward. Mr. Schultz, maybe you just want to hang out in case we have questions for you, if that's all right.
Chair, committee members, Senator, my name is Harry Melander. I'm here on behalf of the 55,000 members that are part of the Minnesota Building Trades Council reside in all parts of the state. Our organization is very supportive of Senate File 549. We believe that it transitions the elevator constructor, the constructor license, from an electrical-based license to an elevator-based license. It also updates the elevator constructor and elevator constructor license qualification. This bill has been a community effort, a partnership between the elevator constructors, their employers, and the Department of Labor and Industry. As indicated by a couple of comments, this is a very, very dangerous industry. Elevator constructors, not only from the installation but the decommissioning, are not only taking their lives in their own hands, but also, more importantly, or as important, the public. So we believe that this is a good bill and that there is no internal issues in regards to work from our community. So I'll stand for questions, but we wholeheartedly support this.
Thank you, Mr. Melander. Are there any questions for Mr. Melander?
Senator
Dames.
I don't know if this is specifically for Mr. Melander, who would ever like to answer, but on subdivision 9, it just says the scope of work of the contract to perform is limited by the scope of the practice of the responsible individual. The next sentence, the person is responsible individual for only one contractor. Wouldn't it be, if we have more than one contractor on the job, dealing with this issue, wouldn't it be more efficient dollar-wise to allow that individual to work for more than one contractor? Is there any specific reason why we're not allowing that individual to work for more than one contractor?
Ms. Senator Tomasoni or Mr. Schulte, do you have the bill or do you?
I took it off of the overview. Oh.
Which section did you reference?
Sure. Section 12, subdivision 9.
Can you respond? Well, we have a response here. So.
Okay. Mr. Schultz?
Chairman, Senator Dumbs, I believe you're referring to Subdivision 9 that begins on line 7.23 and extending through 7.29, correct?
Yes, I'm looking at the overview, which you may not have. The overview just states that a person can be responsible and legal for only one contractor. So you have to match that up with the language in here. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Mr. Schultz.
8.10 is the. It's on page 8, line 8.10.
Mr. Chairman.
May be responsible individual for any one contractor.
Mr. Schultz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dumbs, and committee members. This is a fairly common provision within the licensing model in Chapter 326B. Similar language applies currently on electrical licensing. It also applies to plumbing licensing. Basically, it's requiring that under that contractor licensing model that there be a responsible licensed individual. Typically, it's a master license holder. That master license holder then is committed basically to being the responsible master license for that one contractor and can't be for multiple contractors. In effect, it ensures that there is that responsible person that is dedicated to that contractor rather than for multiple contractors.
Senator Dames, is that helpful?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Any other questions from committee members? Would anyone like to testify in opposition to Senate File 549? And Senator Tomasoni, I guess we'll leave up to the committee if Senator Dames is comfortable. Obviously, we want this committee to do its work, but are you comfortable enough to let it to go? You're right? Okay. All right. Okay. Any further discussion from committee members? Yeah. Senator Schmidt would move that Senate file 549, I apologize, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Thomas.
Thank you.
Next, last we have Senator Schmidt, Senate file 656. Senator Schmidt, Senate File 656. I believe that, do you have an author's amendment as well, sir?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We have the A1 amendment.
Okay. Get that handed off. Senator Schmidt moves the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails that the author's amendment, A1 amendment, is adopted. Senator Schmidt, to Senate File 656.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have Senate File 656, the Department of Labor and Industry housekeeping bill here today. With the A1 amendment adopted, we have three articles before us, first dealing with construction codes and licensing, the second dealing with combative sports, and the third dealing with manufactured homes. I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers here to take you through the bill.
Ms. Luman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Jessica Luman. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry, and I oversee the Construction Codes and Licensing Divisions as well as the Labor Standards Division. Senator Schmidt has said, this is a housekeeping bill, really to bring a line. As you know, we go through and we make sure that the law says what the practice and policies should be, and appreciate your support on our housekeeping bill. I can go through each section if that's the most helpful, and that might be the easiest, although I see we do, Senate Council has done a very nice summary. And let me just maybe bring a couple of the issues to your attention and clarify a couple of things. In Section 1, it's, again, literally cleanup. We have a statutory reference to 326B that needs to be made, 326 that needs to be made 326B. That's all Section 1 does. I'm just going to do the highlights. That's okay. The only things I want to bring to your attention are in Section 4 and Section 6. They do exactly the same things, which is they include the word use under the purpose of the state building code. That's already in the state building code. It's language that you just want to make sure is referred to in the statute. And what that means is that if you don't change the use of a building, that the building code that applies to your building is the one when it was built. When you change the use of the building, then the new code applies. And the best example of that is if you have an office building, as long as you keep it an office building from the beginning of time, the building code when it was built is the one that applies to that building. If, however, you change that office building into a nursing home, the building code requirements for a nursing home are going to apply because you've created a new use for that building. The other piece I would like to bring to your attention is in Section 5. We're adding to the definition of public building a charter school building. The definition currently includes all public schools, and this would just require that the Department of Labor and Industry have authority and jurisdiction over charter schools, construction projects over $100,000. Again, this is a fundamental safety issue. The final thing I'd like to bring to your attention is in Section 9. This is the Contractor Recovery Fund is a fund that is administered by the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, and this would allow us to make sure that those who are recovering under the Contractor Recovery Fund are owners of real property that are individual owners.
Mr. Rakowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The second article deals with our newest office at the department, effective Senator Bonna, still here?
Yeah.
Well, I can't see. She was co-chair. For those of you who are new to the legislature, I'll give you a 30-second backgrounder on this. The Combative Sports Commission had existed for several years as a separate very tiny agency housed at the Department of Administration. Senator Bonhoff and Representative Kiffmeyer for the last 2 years were co-chairs of what was called the Sunset Commission, where they reviewed all agencies and boards within the executive branch to see if any of them should be sunsetted. There was some contention that the Combative Sports Commission be sunsetted, but because of safety purposes, it was determined that the Commissioner of Labor and Industry would become the Commissioner of the Combative Sports Commission. And so since July 1st, it's been part of the Department of Labor and Industry. Because our department's mission includes workplace safety, and we also process and license over 130,000 individuals and businesses. Oh, good, she's back. And so the commissioner, I'm acting as the commission on behalf of the commissioner. That's why I'm explaining Article 2. The Chapter 341, think of it as merging two agencies. And when you do, you need to make sure that the old statute matches up with the new statute. In the case, for example, of our 326B, our construction code and enforcement statute, that's what Section 1 does. And I like Assistant Commissioner Lumen, I'm just going to highlight a few of the changes we're making because they are very technical. Right now, if this amendment, the first section, applies the CCLD or Construction Code and Licensing Enforcement Statute to combative sports. The other one that is somewhat interesting is that these combatants are automatically after every they have a 7-day suspension Not that they did anything wrong, but just for safety purposes, we don't want these combatants, going and engaging in combative sports, is mixed martial arts, by the way, for the otherwise pejoratively called cage matches, or boxing for that matter. They need a period of rest for the purposes of safety for them. And Section 4 says that the commissioner doesn't have to go through the contested procedures of the Administration Procedure Act if there's a grievance filed or an enforcement statute filed against one of the combatants. And last, the thing of some interest is the last one. Right now, these guys operate on an annual licensing period, and we wanted the licenses all to expire on the same day, December 31st. And because of that, Mr. Chairman, that's a small minor fiscal impact. We're not sure what it is yet because it hasn't happened yet, but we would recommend that this bill be referred to the Environment, Economic Development, and Agriculture Jobs.
Agriculture.
Thank you. I'll stand for any questions on combative sports.
Senator Bonham.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Rakowski, sorry I was out of the room briefly, because I have been so grateful that you guys unwillingly but willingly were willing to take them on. And as I understand it now, the commissioner is enjoying that, right?
Mr. Rakowski? That,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, that is absolutely true. And I had a lot of misconceptions about the sport. Commissioner Peterson and I are of a certain age. You know, we grew up in the golden age of boxing, and this is mixed martial arts is the demographic skews more to the 18 to 30-year-olds. So it's been very interesting learning how the sport operates and how much, when you go to an event, how important safety is to all the folks that we license.
Mr. Rakowski, yeah, that's why we, you know, on the Sunset Commission felt so strongly that to make sure we had the highest standards of both safety and financial controls, that you were best suited. And so, again, thank you for that. And the
thank
changes
you.
Seem to be very sound and in keeping with that intention.
Thank you very much.
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Rakowski, there's nothing in here that includes the legislature under the definition of combative sports, is there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber, yeah. No, but they should be.
Okay, thank you.
Not yet. Thank you. Is there any further questions for the assistant commissioners? Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, and who would ever like to at the table answer this, but we're changing in a lot of cases, we're striking Chapter 326 and changing Chapter 326B. Can you give me just a brief summary of the difference between those two?
Assistant Commissioner?
Chairman, Senator Dames, this is a holdover. As you know, this was a consolidation of five different agencies that occurred in 2006 that brought a bunch of different agencies to the Department of Labor and Industry. And this, as you see the first part of the language, when that happened, all of the functions of those agencies was put into 326B. And this was an area that was identified, this particular chapter was identified as not having made that transition. So you'll notice that boiler operators regulated pursuant to 183, for example, they now are in 326B. The boiler, electrical, plumbing, high pressure piping, elevators.
Residential tender.
Builders, thank you. Those are all now covered under the 326B statutory language.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Are there further questions for the witnesses? Okay. Any further questions for the witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dames.
Just another question on the amendment. We've added Article 3 for manufactured homes. Where have they been before that we're now adding those to the amendment?
Assistant Commissioner, would you be able to help with that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dames, this provision is also already in 326B. 327, sorry. Actually, maybe you should. We have the manufactured housing people here who maybe can help us specifically. I apologize. It is under 327, which is also under the purview of the Department of Labor and Industry.
All right. And maybe council can help a little bit, too. But then if Mr. Go ahead. You can. Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ames, this is a totally independent amendment that has to do with the licensing of manufacturer home sales people. So it has nothing to do with what we were talking about before. So if you just read on page, the lead-in, no application for license A, B, C, D, E. The applicant does not have to satisfy the two-year prior experience requirement. So there was a two-year experience rating or requirement to get a license. And now on lines 7, 8, 9, and 10, we're saying they don't have to have that if they have these qualifications. So.
Good question. Is that good? Mr. Bruner, would you like to comment on it? I think Senator Dames has got some clarification, but if you'd like to say something, you certainly are.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Bruner. I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. We worked with the department on this provision and are supportive. It's a way for someone to obtain a sales license that previously cannot in having to satisfy an experience requirement that would allow them to sell new homes if they own a manufactured home park.
Thank you. And Senator Dames, I apologize. I should have had the author explain a little bit more about the amendment, but that's fine. Thank you for bringing that up. Okay, now are there any further questions for the witnesses or for Senator Schmidt? Seeing none, Senator Schmidt moves that Senate File 656 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Schmidt.
Thank you, members.
With that committee, good work again today.
Good work.
With that, we'll adjourn the meeting.